Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple, broadcasting from Icon Gallery. We have Sonia Gunderson in the studio, or in the gallery studio today. You guys were talking about something when I was out of the room, and when I came back, it was an interesting conversation, so I said, let's start talking about this on the radio.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's something we, I think we're all at least peripherally aware of, is the, you know, the clash of modern society and what's left of the old indigenous societies in the world, and the Inuit are obviously one of the last ones. And I have a friend in Vancouver, on Vancouver Island, who works with the First Nations people there, the Nishka'a, and he's become an ombudsman for them, interfacing between the villagers and the provincial government. In a lot of cases, just trying to reestablish the promises that the government made and never kept. We think maybe American government has not done well in its relations with the indigenous peoples here, but the same situation is true in Canada. But an interesting thing happened in his relationship with these people, and that's that they found that their youngsters were no longer interested in their culture, and they weren't paying attention to the teachings of their elders about how it is and what's important to know. And yet they were willing to listen to my friend John telling them the same information. And so they've made a program of it now. Every spring he leads a large group of young Nishka up into the you know, real wilderness regions of Vancouver Island and teaches them what the tribal elders have been teaching him. And it's interesting that, you know, they'll listen to a white man from East Souk, but they won't listen to their own, you know, their own culture. And I was just wondering, you know, is this same kind of thing going on?
Yeah, up in the Canadian Arctic, I mean, one thing that's really so wonderful about the opportunity to spend time with the Inuit up there. By the way, Inuit, many people used to call them Eskimos. That's a term that's no longer used. Mm-hmm. So Inuit are the people who've occupied that area for over 4,000 years. One thing that's so fortunate up there is that what's happening there now happened with most Native peoples. They call them First Nations in Canada and Native Americans here. That may have happened 200 or 300 years ago with those tribes, so we're very far down the line from the people who actually lived, you know, the traditional lifestyle. The wonderful thing with the Inuit in northern Canada, particularly in Iqaluit, the community where I was living last year, is that those changes happened much more recently. So it's still possible in Iqaluit to speak to elders who who were born in igloos or born in sod houses and lived this semi-nomadic hunting lifestyle, and then to talk to their children, who might be in their 50s or, you know, as young as 45, who were born in igloos or sod houses and then moved into the community. So they're sort of like the bridge generation. And then you can talk to their children and their grandchildren who only know life in the community, even though families up there, for the most part, still have hunting at the center of their lives. So, you know, they're out camping and hunting all the time. It's sort of a joke up there with the schools, that the school in Iqaluit last year started with about 300 students, and by the end of school, there were 42 students in school. As soon as the weather gets good, you know, they're out on the land and camping and so forth. So there's a chance to see that. And there's just a wealth of knowledge. And the irony is, you know, similar to what you're saying, Alan. It's like you know, all this knowledge and people like me and other researchers and arts curators and so forth are all flooding up there to try to interview people. And yet their own children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren think there's nothing too interesting that their grandparents have to teach to them. I guess that's fairly universal. You know, what's really interesting is what I see on TV or something like that. So they will tend to sort of appreciate those things. I initially, when I was up there, started focusing on interviewing elders and going through oral histories up there. Glue Lake happens to have the biggest and most well-organized oral history collection of any place in the world of Inuit oral histories. And it was just, I was like a kid in a candy store. I'd go in there and I could just, you know, search on any topic I was interested in, you know, relationships or death or births or whatever it was, and just, you know, tap into this treasure trove of knowledge. So initially that was really my focus, and I felt a kind of urgency about interviewing these 35 or so elders that are still left in the community. But then, you know, about halfway through the year last year, I realized, wow, you know, there's great knowledge there, but I don't see a lot of it being transferred directly. And, you know, whether this culture lives or dies depends on the youth. So I really pivoted and started interviewing young people and going to the high school and talking to kids in coffee shops and then tracking down all the young hunters and so forth. And I discovered the knowledge is changing, but it's also sort of being rediscovered in certain surprising ways. And two examples of that. In Iglulik, there's a guy who's a circus performer who is actually French-Canadian. His name is Guillaume Saladin. His father is a very famous anthropologist who had studied Iglulik. So Guillaume, as a child, actually spent a lot of time in Iglulik. But he went on to study circus skills at the Montreal Circus School, joined Cirque Eloise, which is a spin-off of Cirque du Soleil. And so he was involved in this career as a circus performer. But he still would hear news from Iglulik. And he started hearing how many suicides there were. And suicide is just a huge problem in the north. I think the suicide rate is something like 11 times what it is anyplace else in North America. So he said, we've got to do something for the young people in Iglulik. So he actually left Cirque Eloise, went up to Iglulik, took a bunch of circus performers with him. This is 11 years ago. And started a circus company called Art Cirque with Inuit kids. And the kids, you know, just became this big focus. At this point, the circus troupe, you know, has gotten a fair amount of notoriety and is getting invitations to perform all over the world. And the interesting thing I found in interviewing the kids that were in the circus in town is that when they would go to France or to Switzerland or to Mexico, or they even went to Timbuktu while I was there, which is actually a place, I never knew that before, in Mali. So they went there to perform at an African arts festival. What happened to them was they started to be proud of being Inuit. People kept coming up, tell us about your culture, and so forth. And also Guillaume has been smart enough to really center the performances around cultural themes. And so through the circus, they've gotten back into things like throat singing and drum dancing and various Inuit legends and various types of games that they would play and that kind of thing. So it's such an unexpected kind of twist, you know, that through the circus that this would happen. So the kids that actually had the opportunity to find through something that they thought was really cool because it came from the outside, the circus, they actually had a chance to come back to a lot of cultural values and traditions that that their grandparents really wanted to pass on. The same thing has happened in the Arctic with hip-hop. A social worker from Ottawa has been conducting one-week workshops all over the Arctic, and the kids just flock to these things. I mean, kids that on a normal day you would never be able to get them up before noon because they've stayed up all night long, they're there at 8 o'clock in the morning to learn hip-hop. And so what he's done in these hip-hop workshops is to incorporate, it's like a kind of a sharing of traditions and blending of traditions, incorporate a lot of Inuit knowledge and values. And as a result, the elders are really excited about these hip-hop workshops. And they actually, you know, make costumes for the kids to perform in. They try hip-hop themselves and things like that. I'm actually going up. I've gotten really interested in hip-hop up there. And I've been invited at the end of March to go back up there. There's going to be a hip-hop summit, leadership summit, where they're bringing in hip-hop kids from all over the Arctic to one community. To sort of work with them and deepen those leadership skills. And the really wonderful thing about this is that in every community where they've developed a strong hip-hop program, and that really depends on having a lot of local support, suicide rates have gone down. Kids stop drinking and doing drugs, which is a huge problem as well. The kids start, you know, doing community service and all of that. So it's been so successful that the government of Nunavut, which is the territory that we're talking about, this new Inuit-controlled territory in Canada, has recently announced that they're pumping another $400,000 into hip-hop programs.
Who'd have thunk it?
This is great. This is like another movie. You know, somebody should make a movie of this whole story you just told us.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
Fascinating.
The Arctic Hip Hop Summit sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, I mean, even a documentary on that would be.
Yeah, there have actually been about five documentaries on it, and National Geographic is just about to do a big program about it and so forth. So it's, but it's very exciting, you know, when you're interested in sort of seeing what happens when a culture starts to change, and how a group like the Inuit, whose whole survival has depended on being very adaptable and being very resourceful and so forth, how they, you know, sort of blend things. And it makes you start to question, you know, what do we even mean when we talk about a culture?
Yeah,
you know?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, I people used to tell me when I was a kid about the fall of the Roman Empire, and I had this vision of this vast empire, which as a kid I knew, you know, full of these centurions roaming around and vast armies and stuff, and it just sort of collapsed. And yet that's not at all what happened. It didn't collapse. It got digested by Europe. And every culture in Europe has substantial aspects of Roman culture in it. And what collapsed in Rome was just the you know, in the unadaptable aspects of Roman culture. The rest of it is Italy, for heaven's sakes, you know. It's not like there's a big empty place where Rome used to be. And it's the same thing. I mean, cultures diffuse. They don't come and go. They in a sense they never stop.
The interesting thing with the Inuit is that the whole culture has sort of sprung out of this very intimate relationship that they have with their environment.
Yeah.
And really, you know, it doesn't take long to realize that how insignificant one is in that environment. I mean, the environment really dictates everything.
Well, that's 7 weeks of no sun.
Yeah, 7 weeks of no sun. That was the only thing I was a little bit nervous about, spending the winter there. I just didn't know how I would deal with that. But it actually was really a wonderful kind of spiritual inward time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't all that dark. I mean, there were still a few hours of twilight.
Yeah.
but you just didn't see the sun for 7 weeks.
Yeah.
And how cold was it?
How cold was it?
I think the coldest it actual temperature was while I was up there was like minus 58 Fahrenheit. Yeah.
So that's it gets, before the wind chill factor.
That's before the wind chill factor. Yeah, this time of year up there, actually February and March tend to be the coldest months up there. And I remember where I was staying, seeing things that I'd never seen before. I mean, it's like when it would snow, there are no trees, of course, because it's above the tree line. And so the winds, if you've got a blizzard, the winds will just make it snow horizontally. Mm-hmm. And so you would open the front door and there'd be like 10 or 12 inches of snow on the door. You'd have to shovel the door. Or it would get so cold that, you know, every home has like an entryway. So that you can sort of quickly get out of the cold and then you take your boots off or whatever. And I would see frost, you know, just coming through like every nail hole or every crack. I mean, places that you normally wouldn't even notice would just have an ice buildup on the inside and so forth. So, you know, you really get to have a very healthy respect for the weather up there. And you just adapt to it. You just, you know, have to dress properly and that kind of thing.
Well, can you expose your skin at all in that? Or do you have to, like, wear a scarf over your face?
And you would wear a mask and things like that. Yeah, if you were going to be out at all, you would wear goggles and just, you wouldn't have anything exposed.
Now, there's something I want to get in before our time is up. You talk about Inuit artists, and you were talking about some really great artists, and you wanted to interviewed different ones. Are we talking about the traditional arts of the Inuit, or is there something of a contemporary art scene going on up there?
Oh, there's a very active contemporary art scene going on, but it was, if you go back before Inuit were sort of forced into these settlements, most of the art had to do, they have a very rich shamanic tradition. So most of the art had to do with little, you know, icons that they would sort of carve out of stone or whalebone or something for use
like
in shamanic.
Amulet or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that's probably because that was, you know, that was a major part of their lives, but also because they were moving all the time. They wouldn't be making big sculptures, you know, and then carrying those with them on dog sleds.
No Madonna and Child canvases up there.
Or a little marble sculpture.
Yeah. But...
Well, that would make sense. I mean, that does make sense.
And they never did have, you know, money or currency or anything like that. I mean, the whole culture was just based on sharing food or expertise or whatever. But once they were sort of forced into these settlements because the Canadian government wanted to sort of have a stable population so they could say, okay, the Arctic belongs to us. So they actually forced Inuit to sort of settle in these communities. Then they sort of, a Western lifestyle was imposed on them and they had to earn money and things like that. So art was really kind of introduced, particularly starting in the community of Cape Dorset, which is the center of Inuit art for the world. It was introduced there. They brought in southern, from an Inuit perspective, just means anybody that doesn't live above the Arctic Circle. So you could say southern Western. They would bring in printmakers to teach the Inuit printmaking, or they'd bring in sculptors and so forth. So, you know, they Inuit are just so visually oriented. They're incredible observers. Their whole survival is dependent on being very acute observers. So they just picked things up very quickly and mastered those skills. So there's been for probably 60 years now a very rich tradition of sculpture, printmaking. There are certain communities that sort of specialize in weaving and textiles. and so forth. And so they will, you know, they will use whatever materials are at hand. What I discovered fairly quickly, even in interviewing some of the best artists, is it baffled me at the beginning, because I would, you know, go into some world famous artist's home. I would not see one piece of art. And it just was like, I very quickly got, oh, this is actually not something they care about. It's an economic activity as far as they're concerned.
Interesting.
So they, you know, support, there are many artists. I mean, I think in Cape Dorset, there's something like 70 world-class artists, you know, who are there. So it's a major part of their lives. Living with the Inuit family that I was living with last year, Luki Irut, who's the father of the family, is probably the best known artist. He and his brother are the best known artists in Iglulik. And, you know, their work is in museums all over the world. But he would never sort of say, oh, I feel inspired to make something today. It was kind of like, we need food. I better get out there to the shed and make something, you know.
But when in the process of making, they're making aesthetic decisions that please them,
right?
I imagine, yeah.
Right. And one of the things, actually, when I was writing a profile of Luki for the Inuit Art Quarterly, I interviewed various people he hunted with and other artists and so forth about him. And one of the things that the filmmaker Zach Kunuk said about Luki was, he said, anything Luki touches, he turns into art. So if he's making a sled, it's the most beautiful sled in town. If he's making an igloo, it's the most beautiful igloo you'll ever see, and so forth. So he carried that kind of aesthetic and also real technical expertise into everything that he did. When I was living at the house, there was a washer and a dryer, and it turned out, I just learned this, you know, incidentally one day, he had actually built the washer by going to the dump and scavenging parts. And he built a washer that had, you know, been working for 3 years at that point. So, you know, the mastery that Inuit have over practical things is just mind-boggling to me. I mean, what they can make out of nothing is just amazing.
Well, I can see why you wanted to go back there 5 times. I mean, you're just making me want to go meet these people. It just sounds so... By the way, we've been speaking with Sonia Gunderson, in case you tuned in, since we... after we started the show. This is our second show in a row that we've done with Sonia, and we could easily do, I think, 5 more with all of these wonderful stories. Just absolutely fascinating about her life with the Inuit people in northern Canada, in the Arctic area of Canada.
Now, do they travel at all much? Do they stay pretty much in their own little community? Do they go back and forth between communities, or do they ever go to the south, that foreign region?
One thing about the Arctic is that you can't just go from community to community easily, because there are no roads. In the winter, when the ice freezes, you know, the ocean becomes a road of sorts, and so forth. Many of the people do fly out for various reasons, and usually that's paid for in some way by the government. There's no, you know, really substantial health care that's available locally. People can't even have babies locally. So there's a lot of medical travel that's sponsored by the government.
By the government, you mean?
The government of Canada.
Okay.
I mean, Nunavut, this territory where Iglulik is located, is the newest territory in Canada. It's actually, most of it used to be the Northwest Territories. So right. In 1999, they just took a huge chunk of Northwest Territories. It's about the size of Western Europe, and made it into a new territory that's more or less controlled by the Inuit, but it's not totally self-sustaining. So a lot of its funding comes from Canada. So people do get out like that. If, you know, because Inuit originally were semi-nomadic, meaning that it wasn't just that they would just sort of travel all over the place. They had places they would go because the game would be there in the fall, and other places in the winter, other places in the spring, and so forth. So they had certain places they tended to go. That's very natural to them. What's very unnatural, and they would do that in small family groups. What's unnatural to them is to be cooped up in a Western-style community with everything, you know, whether it's politics or healthcare, education, or whatever, not being natural to them. Mm. Some of them have told me they feel, when they're in their community, they feel incarcerated. And to go with them out on the land is the most amazing experience, because it's just like freedom. And you can just feel them. They start to breathe again, you know, and they never want to go back. They'll even say, when you're out on a seal hunt with them or something, oh, now we have to go back to Kalanani, which means white man's land, you know, white man's place. So they never feel as relaxed. And you can see the same person in the community and on the land, and it's Jekyll and Hyde. On the land, they're full of life, they're focused, they're happy. In the community, it's like the life force is taken out of them.
And so, how long do they go out on a hunt like that, or out on the land?
They may go hunting for just an afternoon. Snowmobiles make that possible, or it could be for a week or two.
So, and no one lives out in an igloo anymore?
No.
Thank you so much for these interviews.
Oh, this They've has just been wonderful.
It's been fun for me too. Thanks.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.